From WXXI News, this is Connections, broadcasting live from our WEOS studios in Geneva. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on April 21st at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Outgoing President Mark Guerin welcomed the college's new president, Dr. Gregory Vincent. For the first time, the colleges would be led by a former HWS student and grad, and for the first time, the colleges would be led by an African American. Vincent has a fascinating personal story and resume, most of which you haven't heard. If you have heard his name, it's because Vincent was involved in one of the most high-profile cases regarding affirmative action, a case that went to the Supreme Court and decided just a year ago. And it was one of the final cases involving the late Justice Antonin Scalia, whose remarks about race on campus sparked national headlines. Well, this hour, we have a chance to sit down with Dr. Vincent to get his perspective on a wide range of issues. Yes, that case, of course, but also the future of equality and opportunity on college campuses. When he accepted the job, he closed with a promise to make HWS a place where everyone can feel respect. Let's listen to that moment.
I pledge to do everything I can to enhance teaching and learning, and to foster a climate of inclusion and respect. And to our students, I pledge to work every day so that you have the same wonder, the same connection to ideas and experiences, and that same mentorship that I experienced as a student. I am honored to serve as your next president. Thank you.
And with that, I'll say hello here in studio to Dr. Gregory Vincent, president of Hobart and William Smith Colleges and a 1983 graduate of HWS. Nice to see you here.
It's an honor to be here today.
Well, and I know that it's been very busy for you, so thank you so much for making the time for us. 1983 graduate, we were talking before the program began about how much you have seen things change here. Most of it's still the same. Does it feel still pretty familiar to you?
So the same spirit, the same magic that I enjoyed as a student here at the colleges is still there. But to see some of the great new facilities and to see how Geneva has grown and developed in the last 3-4 decades has been truly outstanding.
What is taking up most of your time in the early days here?
Meeting people, connecting with people, making sure that I reach out and be present. And Mark, as you know, Mark Guerin did such a wonderful job. And just to make sure that whether it's our partners in the community, our students, faculty, and staff, that they know that same momentum is going to continue.
Talking to Dr. Vincent for the hour, and listeners, if you want to join the program, you can do that in multiple ways. We can get some of your calls later in the hour, but I think you should know a little bit about his background because he just came from the University of Texas with 50,000 students to HWS, which has 2,300 students. You also grew up in New York City?
That's correct.
So, you know, you're used to the big campus in the big city, and here you're in the small space. Is that an adjustment for you?
You know, it is an adjustment to live in a small city, but it is clear to me that Geneva is such a great place to live. And as you know, it was named an All-America City, got a second downtown revitalization grant. And I'm excited about building this connection between Hobart and William Smith Colleges and Geneva. And again, that's one of Mark Guerin's hallmark achievements. And I look forward to continuing that. And I share with people around the country that this connection between HWS and Geneva is really a national exemplar.
I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about your background, starting with your parents. I'm just going to read a little bit about the bios that we've put together, and you can kind of pick it up from there. But
okay.
I just thought such fascinating personal stories. Your dad, a first-generation American and college student who served in one of the last racially segregated units in the Army during the Korean War. Your mother earned her master's while caring for her parents and raising three kids. She served on the school board, elected in 1970, 5 years after the 1965 Voting Rights Act, and was one of only 1,400 African Americans elected officials in the country at that time. Both those, is that accurate?
Absolutely, that's right.
And when did you really become sort of aware of just how significant that was?
Yeah, I think really with my mother, because I would go to school board meetings with her. I would be part of her campaigns, dropping off literature. It's kind of old school back then. And just seeing just how she connected with people. My mother and I were very similar in that we're extroverts. We enjoy connecting with people. She never met a stranger. And so it was really, really cool to see, and her passion and how much she cared. And she treated all children like her own. And that was something that really kind of stuck with me, her passion. My father, it was always fun to go visit my father at his work. My dad is an electrical engineer by profession and worked for the New York City Transit Authority. And so it was so cool to go down there and to see how the trains work and the command center. So it was always fun. And we always did fun things when I would go and visit him. And so it was a real joy. And then later, of course, really having a much better understanding of just the achievements and what he was, you know, able to do. And for me, really, my first introduction to college was his alma mater, City College of New York, and how proud he was of, you know, to be an alum. And later, of course, understanding what that meant for my grandparents, both sets of grandparents, to immigrate to the United States at the turn of the beginning of the 20th century, and then have this opportunity to go to college for free, and what that meant for us, and really that sense of service that my parents had because they had that opportunity to go to college, and that meant a great deal. And so service became a very important part of what we were about as a family.
I wonder if the more time that passes, the more it feels like sanctioned segregation feels like part of the distant past. But that was your dad in a unit, one of the last units, a segregated unit.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. And even after Truman integrates the troops, it's still the case that my father was there. What was interesting with my father, who grew up in the North, one of the byproducts of that is that he met lifelong friends who went to historically black colleges in the South. He was stationed at Fort Sill in Oklahoma, and so it was really interesting hearing his stories there. But it really just reinforced for him that sense he was proud to serve his country. At the same time, it was really in his face that discrimination, segregation was still alive and well.
And so as you kind of learn from them, you follow your dad, went to, you said, City College in New York.
That's right.
You're thinking about higher education. What was it that brought you here to Geneva and HWS?
Well, two things. One, as you know, Hobart and William Smith Colleges has strong Episcopal roots, where we grew up in an Episcopal church. My rector was the person who recommended Hobart and William Smith as a great school with a great academic tradition. I had thoughts about potentially becoming an Episcopal priest, and so this was just a great opportunity to continue with that tradition. My best friend in high school, I went to the Bronx High School of Science. His older sister, was going into her senior year at William Smith, and she was just so pleased with the school. She was the biggest cheerleader, and so those two connections between now Judge Laura Douglas and my rector was really the two things that really brought me here.
And I want to talk about what led you into the world of academia, because it wasn't always that the case for you. So take me through your educational path before we get to the academia part.
Sure. So I went to, after graduating in 1983, I worked for a year for a not-for-profit organization in Harlem, and then was fortunate to get a scholarship to go to the Ohio State University College of Law. And that was important because it allowed me to practice law in the public sector and not have to worry about significant debt. And so even though I did work for a firm for a while, I eventually got an appointment to serve as an assistant attorney general in Ohio in the civil rights section. And for me, that was really a great opportunity because I was able to work in a lot of different areas. And for example, the Americans with Disabilities Act was enacted in the early 90s. And so one of the things we had to do was make that law applicable to Ohio. So worked on those issues. There were some economic issues, the downturn. And so there was some age discrimination cases. And so what I learned is that this law to protect persons from discrimination, the Anita Hill situation with sexual harassment. So we were able to work on a variety of different cases, but the most memorable case for me was a case in Cincinnati. It was a housing discrimination case where an applicant, a black woman, had all of the necessary credentials, but she was denied expressly because she was black. This was in 1991, and even though we won the case and we got a substantial judgment, When I handed her her check, I thought she would be happy, and I was excited because we won the case. And what I saw in her face, and was as I can still see it today, was that the one thing that I could never repair was the harm to her dignity. And that was such a powerful, a tragic moment for me, because I recognized that one of my real heroes was Thurgood Marshall and changing the law to make sure people felt protected. But what really drove me into higher education was this idea that we could certainly try to address these things after the harm occurred, but what if we could address these issues and educate and help people understand that we should stop it in the first place so it never happens? And so that really drew me into higher education. And once again, it was one of my mentors, who was the dean of the Hobart College, Clarence Butler, was the person who helped me make my transition into higher education.
Yeah, remarkable story. And I know 1991's been, can you believe it's 26 years since that case, but do you recall, you say that the woman was denied housing because she was black.
The landlord...
Was it literally that overt?
The landlord literally said, and it was... Ohio had a pretty comprehensive housing discrimination law. So even though she lived, she basically said, I live in this house. It was a 4-unit house. And we covered that. But she said, I should not have to live with someone I don't want to live with. So that was her rationale.
And so this is where, you know, your work in the legal field, I think you can help some of our listeners kind of see how discrimination has evolved. One of the things in listening to people far more experienced and smarter than myself, people like you over the years, it has occurred to me that in the movement towards civil rights, you take sort of the low-hanging fruits, the, you know, separate but equal, separate bathroom, separate, I mean, like the stuff that should be obvious, that's right in front of you, that's overt. A landlord saying, I don't want to live with someone who is black. Whatever the case is, the overt stuff is quote-unquote easier to target, to understand and to kind of stamp out. What the concern I have is that what remains is structural racism that's a little more subtle, or now landlords figure out how to discriminate without being so overt. But then the complacency, particularly among white people, that, well, haven't we kind of moved past that? What do you see?
You're so spot on. If you dial back the time to when Thurgood Marshall and Charles Hamilton Houston were trying to figure out what would be their legal strategy, there were so many issues to deal with. There was lynching, there was criminal justice issues, there was housing, and certainly one of the great housing cases, the Shelley versus Kramer case, was one where addressed restrictive covenants, which is what you were getting at, and work issues. As you know, Thurgood Marshall decided to pursue an education strategy and to integrate education, first higher education and K-12, which led to the Brown case, because the feeling was if you get a good education, some of these other issues would get addressed, and realizing they couldn't address everything. But why your point is so powerful is that hyper-racial segregation is still an issue today. And one book that squarely addressed this was Doug Massey's book, American Apartheid, that really talked about the government's role in making sure that ghettos were created and that through restrictive covenants, through the inability to get VA or GI Bill loans were such a huge issue for African Americans and other people of color, how redlining occurred. So that legacy is still here, where public housing was established. So all of those things led to that, where interstate highways were placed in the 50s. So all of these things led to some of the hypersegregation that we see even today.
And today we still have a ways to go to sort of achieve what anyway we would call anything resembling equality. And hopefully we're on our way in kind of this slow march. Are you an optimist?
I am ever an optimist. I always think our best days are ahead of us. And so, but we still have significant challenges and also opportunities. And so we definitely need to address that. And I think the one thing that we can do through education is help everyone understand it's in our collective interest to make sure that everyone has an opportunity. And that's, again, why I'm so excited about the work Hobart and William Smith Colleges through Geneva 2020, working with the Geneva Schools, with the Boys and Girls Club, because that is the way we're going to make our community even more healthy.
Talking to Dr. Gregory Vincent, who is Hobart and William Smith College's new president. His first day at HWS was Monday the 17th?
That's correct.
That's 3 days ago?
That's right.
Oh, Well, it's fitting us in your first week. Thank you. Though I suspect since April when it was announced, you've had a lot to do. So, but we're talking to Dr. Vincent about his path to Hobart and then at how he sees the future of higher education. And you might have seen his name in the news occasionally during the process of dealing with this affirmative action case that started at the University of Texas. And what I want to do for our listeners is just sort of pull back and remind you of the circumstances there, because the state of Texas had a 10% rule that still exists.
That's correct.
All right, so let's kind of get the framework so our listeners understand what happened and what led to this. So explain the 10% rule first.
So what really was the impetus of the top 10% rule was a horrible Fifth Circuit decision, the Hopwood versus University of Texas case, where the University of Texas was sued and the Fifth Circuit, which is comprised of Louisiana, Texas, and Mississippi, ruled that race is not an issue in these three states. And what I share with my students is that if race is an issue anywhere, it's in Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. Yet the court banned all use of race in the consideration of admissions. And it really did have a significant adverse impact on admissions at the University of Texas. At one point, there was only one black student in the first year class of the University of Texas. I think that was 1997 or 1998.
That is amazing.
It is amazing. And there were students who were admitted. They just didn't go. So the legislature, in an effort to address this issue and in cooperation with the university, enacted this top 10% rule where any student in the top 10% of a public high school was automatically admitted to the university, any public university, but particularly University of Texas at Austin. And again, picking up on this theme of residential segregation, even though it was supposedly race neutral because of racial segregation in places like Dallas and Houston and Austin and San Antonio, you did get diversity because of the schools that were virtually all black. And then if you look at places like in the Valley and San Antonio, virtually all Hispanic. But what it also had an unintended impact. One of the things that happened at the University of Texas at Austin was that we were only getting students from a select group of high schools. It really did democratize access. And so you had more students coming from West Texas. And so this really became a bipartisan effort, because what legislators began to see was that their students were going to the university. That got challenged by Abigail Fisher, because she felt that that we should no longer use race, and that was after.
Can you tell me if the way the media reported this is correct? Because what we heard about Abigail Fisher, 2008, white student, did not graduate in the top 10% of her class, so she was then automatically admitted to UT. Wanted to go to UT and decided that, well, I didn't get in, and because if you're not in the top 10%, then the university can consider race. And because of that, you admitted some students of color who would have been below my academic criteria. And that was discrimination against me as a white student. That's kind of how the media portrayed it. Is that correct?
That's what she claimed.
That was she claimed.
Right. So just to be clear, so this was in 2003, the Supreme Court addressed this issue in the Grutter v. Bollinger case, which basically reaffirmed that race could be used as one of many factors in admissions. And so after that 2003 decision, the University of Texas decided to do two things. One, continue to use the top 10% rule, but then also for the group of students who are not in the top 10%, and for those spaces available, we did use race in concert
as
with the Grutter decision.
As just one factor.
Right. So Abigail Fisher did say that but for this rule, she would have been admitted. And so what we were able to show was that there were white students, a significant number of white students, who had lower grades than Abigail Fisher, who were admitted, and there were black and Hispanic students that had higher scores but were denied. And I think for us, that was one of the most significant things, particularly for Judge Kennedy, who wrote the majority opinion, to show that this was not the deciding factor. It was one among many.
I want to listen, if we could, and Rob, our engineer back in Rochester, I'll say we're going to listen to what Justice Scalia had to say about this. Now, this is the late Justice Antonin Scalia made some headlines when arguments were being made in this case. Justice Scalia was probing this idea that, well, if we use affirmative action and we bring in students of color to elite schools, And they're not really academically prepared. That's not good for them anyway, because they'll struggle, they'll fail out, and they should be going to sort of less rigorous schools. That's sort of, at least, again, the way the media was summarizing what Scalia said, though some, like CNN, had a headline that said, just Scalia says, maybe blacks shouldn't go to elite schools. I want to listen to the actual audio of Justice Scalia himself in some of those conversations that were happening at the Supreme Court about this case. Let's listen.
There are those who contend that it does not benefit African Americans to get them into the University of Texas where they do not do well, as opposed to having them go to a less advanced school, a slower track school, where they do well. One of the briefs pointed out that most of the black scientists in this country don't come from schools like the University of Texas.
So this court
come from lesser schools where they do not feel that they're being pushed ahead in classes that are too fast for them. I'm just not impressed by the fact that the University of Texas may have fewer. Maybe it ought to have fewer, and maybe some. You know, when you take more, the number of blacks, really competent blacks, admitted to lesser schools turns out to be less, and I don't think it stands to reason that it's a good thing for the University of Texas to admit as many blacks as possible. I just don't think.
There's a lot there, but let me get your first reaction listening again to Justice Scalia in that case.
So one of the real honors of my career was to serve as a spokesperson for the University of Texas for the Fisher versus the University of Texas case. And there's so many inaccurate and in fact, false statements in Justice Scalia's remarks. And I was actually in the chambers when he shared it.
When he
actually said that. I heard it was in person.
What was going through your mind when you heard that?
Well, of course, this is a very reverent place. And of course, there's complete silence. But you could tell the body language was just stunning. So let's quickly unpack this.
Yeah.
So what he's referring to was a law professor, Richard Sander from UCLA, wrote a law review article and speaks to this, what they call the mismatch theory. You know, this theory that somehow students should not go to elite schools because they will feel out of place. Well, the Bach and Bowen study shows on the shape of the river clearly demonstrates that the best indication of success is retention rate. If you go to a better school, you're going to rise up to that graduation rate. And that's simply not the case. What is the case at the University of Texas at Austin is that our black and Hispanic students are graduating very close to the same rate as their white students. We're one of the top 50 producers of African-American scientists. That was just not the case. So here's the thing that is, and then if you look at where black students are, black scientists are being produced, it's really two areas, elite schools, so places, Ivy League schools.
Contra what the justice
exactly,
said.
That's exactly the case. In the University of Texas, if you look at the National Science Foundation, and then historically black colleges that have a tradition of producing African-American students because that was their mission, and that is a place where students feel welcomed. There's one school that serves as a shining example, but it speaks to this intentionality. If you look at what Freeman Hrabowski has done at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, which is a relatively new school, he happens to be African-American. He very intentionally created a science infrastructure where students of color could grow and rise. And so what we see is the three greatest producers of African-American scientists are elite schools that contradicts Justice Scalia's comments, historically black colleges that have had that mission, and schools that have intentionally created this infrastructure so that all students, but particularly students of color, can thrive. I found that the statement at best misguided and candidly a racist comment.
As did a lot of people, but when we look at the evidence, especially for some of our conservative listeners, who I recall when this kind of came to the surface, there was some conversation on the program then. The defense of Scalia was, he's not saying black students shouldn't go to elite schools. He's saying when students wouldn't be admitted otherwise, but you pull them into schools, especially at the elite level, It's bad for them. They fail out at higher rates, and then their life does not turn out to be. And what you're saying is the evidence shows that's wrong. Yeah.
What we know is that, so one of the charges for my during my tenure at the University of Texas at Austin was to establish a student success program. And so basically we took the students who, through their numerical credentials, particularly their SAT scores, were below. But we saw other parts of their records that indicated that they would thrive at UT Austin. And we created what was called the Gateway Scholars Program. And as a result of that, these students graduated at a higher rate, had a higher GPA and a first-year persistence rate than their colleagues. And so what we know is that with intentionality, these students can thrive. And they pass calculus and science at the same rate. Now the larger question for us, how are we teaching those courses? As you know, that very often we treated these courses as weed out courses. And is that the most productive way to teach calculus and chemistry? We tweaked that. We put our best professors there and we said that these students can be successful, can thrive. We created calculus boot camps and these students really did thrive and were getting grades that put them in the track to go to graduate school in the sciences or medical school or some other STEM discipline.
And so before we move on to other subjects, just to kind of cap this part of our discussion, I want to read a little bit of what Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote. And again, the decision on this case goes back about a year now, just over a year, and the court decided 4-3 in favor of UT, which Justice Kennedy wrote, you know, should not necessarily be a national model. We're not talking about affirmative action writ large. We're talking about a specific case in a specific school, but it still feels that way. And in a moment, I'd like Dr. Vincent to let us know, now that he's at HWS, does this case have those ripples that we can feel, or is it sort of parochial? But here's what Justice Kennedy wrote. And by the way, it was a 4-3 decision because Justice Scalia had passed away and Justice Kagan recused herself?
Yes, because she was Solicitor General during the case.
Okay, so it was a 4-3 decision, and Justice Kennedy wrote quote, considerable deference is owed to a university in defining those intangible characteristics like student body diversity that are central to its identity and educational mission. But still, it remains an enduring challenge to our nation's education system to reconcile the pursuit of diversity with the constitutional promise of equal treatment and dignity. That's Justice Kennedy. Now, in terms of the dissent, here's Justice Samuel Alito. He writes that UT had discriminated on the basis of race, but had never provided any coherent explanation for its asserted need to do so. Alito wrote, quote, what is at stake is whether university administrators may justify systematic racial discrimination simply by asserting that such discrimination is necessary to achieve the educational benefits of diversity without explaining, much less proving, why the discrimination is needed or how the discriminatory plan is well crafted to serve its objectives, end quote. Thoughts on what Justice Alito said?
Well,
there?
I thought that in referencing the Grutter v. Bollinger case, it was very clear that the researchers who wrote in support of the University of Michigan's policy, that there were education benefits for all students when you have a diverse learning environment. And you need to have sufficient diversity to gain that that benefit, because without it, students in small numbers will feel like they're isolated and will have to speak for their race and will feel that isolation. So that's the first thing. So all students benefit from that. Here's the thing that Justice Kennedy was speaking to, which has been an enduring principle articulated by the Supreme Court, which is deference to academic freedom. This idea that colleges and universities are in the best place to decide who should be admitted to the college, to the university. And because of that, the idea of using this as one factor, and again, I keep going back to this point because in my elevator speech, I always share that there were more Black and Hispanic students denied with higher scores than there were these white students with lower scores than Abigail Fisher who were admitted, which speaks to a variety of factors. So for example, we look at special talents and ability. We look at first generation status. There's so many different factors that we look into that make up this calculus of who should get into the university.
Okay, and then the question going forward is this just a parochial case? Does this have national
ripples? No, I think it did have a significant national implications. You know, it did affirm. It's unusual to take up basically the same issue after the Supreme Court had just ruled on it. And the Supreme Court ruled in 2003, and less than 15 years later, they're still involved, and so that was unusual. So to have two cases in such recent history affirming this, I think it sends a powerful message that's there. But there's still challenges. That's one of the reasons why the balance of the Supreme Court becomes so interesting, and I would not doubt that there will be a challenge again. The lawyers who represented Abigail Fisher are now taking their case to state court. And so I have no doubt that we'll continue to see challenges to access to higher education.
When you took the job here at Hobart and William Smith Colleges and decided to become its next president here, did you take a look at the diversity numbers? I mean, not necessarily as a basis for saying yes, no, but did you kind of review that just out of curiosity?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And certainly, although there are distinctions between public and private colleges and universities, that diversity, having a diverse learning environment, making sure that our students of color don't feel isolated, all those things are key issues, whether you're at a public, small public, or a large, a small private or large public.
And just looking at the total number of students, again, just under 2,300, and the latest numbers from HWS, 71.8% students white here. When it comes to faculty, the percentage of white faculty is 81.3%, only 3.8% black faculty, 2.4% Hispanic faculty, 8.2% Asian faculty. But, you know, that's the case just about everywhere you go. It's higher ed. It's even more significant on the public high schools, for example, and school districts. Do those numbers need to change?
Absolutely. One of the things that that we worked on at the University of Texas at Austin is to increase the pipeline of African American Hispanic students who will go on to get PhDs and to move into the professoriate. And so, as in addition to being a vice president, but also being a professor, that was something that was very important to me. And so I took that very seriously to mentor the next generation of students who would go into the faculty. And so an important initiative for us was our thematic graduate and faculty hire program to make sure that more African-American and Hispanic faculty would go into higher education. As a public research university, one of our main missions was to increase the number of PhDs and produce those PhDs. And so for us to be able to recruit over 70 black faculty during my tenure, my 12-year tenure, was something that was pretty, one of the most important things that we accomplished at UT.
Talking to Dr. Gregory Vincent, the new president of Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Let's get our only break of the hour. I'm way late for that. And I've been selfish. It's been all my questions, and it just occurred to me that I haven't even told you the phone number. If you want to call the program, you can do that. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI. If you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. We're broadcasting live from our WEOS studios in Geneva, Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM. And Greg Cotterill, Kelly Walker, the team down here do wonderful work, and we're just thrilled to be on Finger Lakes Public Radio every day. But broadcasting from here today with Dr. Vincent. So we've got a few emails already, edawson@wxxi.org. You can find us on Twitter as well. We'll get more of your questions in and continue our conversation with Dr. Vincent after our only break of the hour. Coming up in our second hour, it's the Summer of Food on Connections. Every Thursday at 1 o'clock this summer, a different conversation about food when it comes to trends, the industry, and more. And we're looking at food and waste, a big problem in our country, a big form of waste, but we might have a glimpse at the future, or really the present, on dealing with waste, what we all can do better, what we all can learn next hour on dealing with food waste. Welcome back to Connections, live from our WEOS studios in Geneva with Dr. Gregory Vincent, who is the new president of Hobart and William Smith Colleges. He happens to be the first graduate of HWS to become a president here and the first African-American as well at this school. And so these schools, I keep saying these schools, the colleges. We still say the colleges, right?
That's correct.
HWS, it's easier that way. A couple of listener emails. One on, let's do Jack's first, because Jack just wants to know, Evan, does this essentially mean that affirmative action is sort of a dead issue, that the Supreme Court won't take it up again? Is it here to stay? What does your guest think?
No, I think given the current thoughts on the Supreme Court is that with Justice Gorsuch coming on, I do think that there may be another challenge. I think the leadership in higher education believes this is a settled issue, that we've addressed it in 2003. We addressed it again in 2016. But I could certainly see another challenge in the next few years.
Okay. And let's take a phone call on line one. This is Rosie in Rochester. Go ahead, Rosie.
Yes, hi. I'm very grateful for this conversation. I want to share that it really amazes and stuns and disturbs me that there is still a perspective out there in this nation that there isn't an inherent value of building diversity and the educational experience. I grew up in a situation where I was in an all-white environment. From the time that I was in kindergarten to the time that I graduated, I was the only black female in my class. I cannot even begin to share the wealth of what I learned from that experience and what I took home to my family, and also what I educated my peers. A favorite experience that I often refer to is a very close friend in high school who said to me in the midst of a conversation, "Oh, you're different. You're not like the rest of your people." And I had to educate my dear friend on what she was saying when she said that. And she learned from that, and we are still wonderful friends, and she's so appreciative of the perspective that I was able to bring into her life as the only female of color, or only person of color, really, in her world. And beyond that, I went on, fortunately, as a result of that wonderful education that I stepped up to in that environment, I went on to college and to graduate school. And I want to cite the fact that when you get to graduate school, you are no longer really graded on, with that number two pencil, the bubble you fill in and get the right answer. When you get to that higher level of education, it's really about critical thinking and debate and dialogue. And that is the crux of what you really experience in graduate school. And yet people will say, and obviously debating and experiencing people from different perspectives, regardless of the bubble they filled in on that written exam, is invaluable. And so I just wanted to share that it shocks me that there's so many people who still don't understand that, and that, yes, it is important to build that diversity regardless of those test results and in a situation where you really want your students to get the most out of that learning experience. I'll hang up for your comment.
Rosie, thank you for the phone call. And I will just say, you sound like a very generous person. You've built this friendship with the person who said something to you that certainly was offensive, but you took the time to sort of educate someone, and just pretty remarkable story. But I'll let Dr. Vincent respond. Go ahead.
Well, thank you, Rosie. But the first thing I want to do is put in a plug for a liberal arts education at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. I can assure you that one of the things that our students receive is a real exposure to critical thinking. And I know I personally benefited from the intensive writing experience and the critical thinking experience that I got as an undergraduate. And that certainly served me well, both in law school as well as graduate school. So moving on, I do think what you're pointing to is exactly why having a diverse learning environment is so important. I learned so much, not just in the classroom, but in residence life, in the dining halls with my teammates and classmates. All of those things. I remember one of my teammates said that that he thought the ref was anti-Semitic. I had never heard that term before. And I'm like, what is so I did what my parents taught me to do. I'm like, what does anti-Semitic mean? I didn't realize that he was Jewish. And so for me, it was a really powerful experience to understand these issues. Having classmates who came from the counties in Appalachia here in New York was a very powerful experience, and so doing that. But one of the reasons why this issue is so, that Rosie raises, is so important, because too often the schools with the lowest amount of resources, the least tenured teachers, are the ones in these hyper-segregated areas with Black and Hispanics. And so that's part of the issue. How do we make sure that these students get the resources they need so that they can have a good education in addition to that exposure we were talking about?
Let me just get one more listener tweet. We'll take another listener phone call, and then I want to get an email that Ken wanted to know about cost of higher ed and some of the other plans for Dr. Vinson. You never heard about cost of higher ed as an issue, did you? But Buster writes to us on Twitter, and he says, I'm proud that Dr. Vinson has the courage to call Scalia comments in the Fisher case racist. Hobart and William Smith Colleges needs more candor like this. That's from Buster on Twitter. Ellie in Avon is on the line, line two. Let's take Ellie's call now. Go ahead, Ellie.
Hi, Evan. Hi, Dr. Vinson. I was just listening to the program, and I wanted to comment. I grew up in this area, and I grew up below the average income in this area as a light-skinned Hispanic woman in a very, very, very white area. I went to Princeton University for my undergraduate, and I can tell you, we need more diversity in our elite institutions. We have a disproportionate number of our nation's leaders coming from these institutions, and they don't know anything but what they've been exposed to. They don't know what it's like to be broke. They don't know what it's like to be Black. They don't know what it's like to have to struggle or to have families that are broken. They honestly have no clue. And when they have the exposure and when they are encouraged to have critical thinking that includes thinking other than the one that they are familiar with, that benefits everybody. It is it's economically important because increased diversity increases innovation and creativity, which is good for the bottom line of research and development of companies. It's good for our country, especially as we increasingly fracture along political and socioeconomic lines. It's good for us all around. And I am actually very concerned. I do a lot of alumni interviewing for incoming freshmen. I am very concerned about the lack of preparation that I see, particularly in low-income and minority students. They don't have access to the same number of programs, the same number of extracurricular helps that you see middle-class white American students have. And I don't know how to fix it, but I would love to hear your ideas about what I can do to encourage these students who come across my path on how to prepare themselves for more than just another four-year degree.
All right. Thank you, Ellie. Go ahead, Dr. Benson.
Well, Ellie, again, thank you for calling in. And you are spot on about that exposure and exposure to diversity in all dimensions, and having a curriculum that exposes students to different ways of thinking. I think one of the things that we can do, and whether it's as alums or as colleges and universities, both public and private, is to reach out to K-12. And that's why I'm so proud of what former President Guerin, President Emeritus Guerin, and the team here at HWS did in connecting, seeing that there were real issues here in Geneva. And so one of the things that we can do, there's certainly, I'm a member of two fraternities that have taken this on to reach out and to mentor young people to make sure that they have the exposure and candidly the capital they need in order to thrive. And that's why our partnership, for example, with the Geneva Boys and Girls Club is such an important part of what we do.
A listener named Ken wanted to know your thoughts just on, he said, your guest is coming into a great institution, but the cost of higher education is important. Wants to know your thoughts on that.
Absolutely. One of the key things, and as I mentioned, you know, my parents went to school for free. I was very fortunate to get a scholarship to Hobart and William Smith Colleges and both graduate school and law school, and that allowed me to have different career choices. It is clear that affordability is one of the key issues in higher education, and one of the things that we have to do at a mega level is help everyone understand that higher education is a public good. I think one of the real challenges that we've seen over the last three decades has been increasingly higher education is seen as a private good. And if it's a private good, well, the consumer, that person should be the one to pay for it. Well, that couldn't be any further than the case. This investment in higher education is one of the best investments I believe the public can make. And my parents, as I mentioned, were eternally grateful for the investment. And they always talk to us about that, that, you know, one of the reasons why my dad worked in the public sector was because he wanted to give back and pay back the investment that was made in him. And so I do think we have to begin to address that. I think New York State is beginning to do that. And I think more and more we have to make that happen. I think that that's something that's a top priority for us at Hobart and William Smith. How do we make this amazing experience more affordable, particularly for those students who are struggling to make that a reality for them. And so we have very generous supporters and donors who really do help with internships and scholarships and the ability to go abroad so that our students can fully take advantage of this opportunity. And by doing that, we do make sure that students, we try to meet as much of the need as possible so that this can be a truly wonderful experience for all.
I don't know if you'll set any benchmarks, but if we sit in this studio 5 years from now, what would be a sign that HWS is going in the direction you want? What will have changed with the cost? Or will the cost have stayed the same? Will the growth slowed? What would be your benchmark?
What would be a great benchmark for me is for the colleges to be able to meet the need of all of our students, so that all of our students have the ability to come regardless of cost. So that would be one. And then with that, all of our students would be have the opportunity to go to study abroad, which is one of our great hallmarks. I had the great opportunity to study in the Czech Republic, and it was just a transformative experience. My children have been able to go when they were in college, and it really was a defining experience for them. That every student had the opportunity to hold a paid internship. And so these are some of the things that I want our students to do while continuing to do the great things around service in the Geneva community.
You know, 90 seconds, so two last questions. Do you retain any Czech? Can you speak any Czech?
I cannot. I do still enjoy Czech beer, yes.
Yes. A man of good taste. And about 90 seconds here, it would be one thing for you to come into a job that is as complex as it is being the leader of a college, of HWS as you are, but you're coming into a place that has established community relations. Mark Guerin did a lot in this community. You talked about Geneva 2020. You know that's going to be part of the role going in. In the last minute or so, describe to me what you think your role is going to be, the mission of HWS in your tenure here, to not just be insular, to be part of the community and to try to make Geneva better, to make the Finger Lakes, Western New York better.
Community engagement, whether it's here in Geneva, the Finger Lakes region, upstate New York, the state, nation, world, has to be part, an essential part of our mission. And that connection, connecting the resources of the colleges to the needs of the community, is one of the best things we can help our students do. When we talk about students leading a life of consequence, that community engagement is part of what we want to instill in our students.
Okay. And you feel like you've kind of come in, you said a lot what you're doing now is meeting people, getting to know even more people in the community at HWS, but also in the wider Geneva community.
That's right. And our elected officials have been so wonderful. Matt Horn, it's been wonderful to be able to reach out. Community leaders have been so warm and generous. But continuing the legacy of President Emeritus Guerin is a real honor, and I look forward to meeting that challenge.
Greg and Kelly here at WEOS will also be consistent presences in your life, and we are thrilled that they're here. They're great colleagues for us at WXXI to have here at WEOS in Geneva. So I know that they'll be in touch with you, so will we, and I hope we can make this a somewhat regular visit because I enjoyed it.
I look forward to it, Evan, and thank you for this opportunity.
Wonderful. That's Dr. Gregory Vincent, the new president of Hobart and William Smith Colleges. We're going to get our hourly break here, and when we come back, we're talking about Summer of Food and the future of, well, a big issue in our country is food waste. What happens with it, and how can we as a society do a lot better with that? There's some innovative ideas coming your way in our next hour as we continue broadcasting live from WEOS in Geneva.